Crowley Arts Center, here for my highly anticipated interview. I'm a little nervous, but I'm gonna get things rocking and rolling. Should be fun. Watch.
So, how are you doing today?
I'm well, Tiffany.
Not too tired?
Doing okay.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. I know you're up pretty early, but we'll get into that later.
Absolutely.
Can you take us back to your childhood and tell us how it was growing up in Montreal?
I am a bona fide Montrealer to the core, born and raised here. Grew up in Park Extension. From there, I've seen just about every neighborhood on the west side. And I guess it's kind of shaped my sensibilities, my admiration for the city. But yet, in spite of it all, most Montrealers don't think I'm from Montreal.
Why not?
Maybe the way I carry myself, the fact that I am perhaps one of the last Anglophones, authentic Anglophones who struggles to speak French. So, yes, that makes me a bit of a unique figure in this city.
Absolutely. And would you be able to tell us about a childhood memory that sparked your interest in music?
In music? My mother and my surrogate father, they both were lovers of music. They kept a rich collection of vinyl. I remember seeing Stevie Wonder, The Mighty Clouds of Joy, Andre Crouch. But in spite of it all, I somehow, at that age, growing up in a predominantly Greek neighborhood, gravitated towards Elton John. Don't ask me why. And I remember going to the vinyl store in downtown Montreal on St. Catherine Street, one called Sam the Record Man, and picking up my first vinyl, and it was Elton John. And knowing that album from top to bottom. So, yeah, gospel didn't come right away. Yeah. It didn't come right away.
So if I were to ask you to describe Christopher Herron, what would you say?
I don't know. I'm somewhat of an enigma in the sense that I don't fit anyone's particular mold. But I would say I'm a lover of music and I'm a lover of the gospel.
And you have so many different roles in terms of your careers. What would you say you identify with the most?
Personally, I identify myself as a writer because when I've explored that and done a lot of writing and published it, it's gotten a resounding positive response, whether it was on social media or working behind the camera, writing script on a television show. So that's something that I take great pride in and something that I thoroughly enjoyed. But I like all aspects of music.
Okay. Let's get deeper into the music aspect of you. How did you initially get into the music industry and why?
There's different steps. One that really strikes a chord with me was the fact that I did go to a private school for a few years in Ontario during my adolescent years, and that was a school that was very rich in music. A lot of talented vocalists, a lot of talented musicians, and it was not something that I was able to mimic, but I had great admiration for it. I even got to the point where I took piano lessons for a year, but that didn't result in anything. So I knew I had to gravitate towards something else, but still stay close to music. Then after graduating from that private school, I returned to Montreal, and I remember a group of us, of friends that were all in our late teens, early 20s, heard about this gospel concert that was taking place in Toronto, of all places. And it was a contemporary gospel group that was a bunch of young men. It was a boys band. It was a literally boys band made up of four guys from Detroit, Michigan, who could sing and play, called Commissioned. And I remember we all rented a van, squeezed 18 people inside, and we went to Toronto. You know, we had pocket change because none of us had a job. We were all in school. And we went, and we were all blown away. I remember the trip back to Montreal. We We literally didn't say anything to each other because we were so overwhelmed mm-hmm. by emotions of how the music and the ministry played on us. And that was when I started to realize that that was something that I wanted to promote locally. Of course, there was Montreal Jubilation Gospel Choir that has always been a landmark here in this city. But I wanted to show them that there were different facets of gospel music, and I figured that one of the areas was to start introducing talent from the United States to here.
Okay. And can you tell us about how it looked like, this, the gospel scene? How did it look like at the beginning of your career?
It was different in the sense that people here in Montreal were not introduced to a variety of styles of gospel music. They understood and recognized Montreal Jubilation Gospel Choir, which was great because they're a Juno Award-winning choir, and they did things with excellence under the direction of Dr. Trevor Payne. But there were other areas of gospel music that were rich in the local churches, female groups, guys groups, praise and worship groups, and those were the types of gospel music that I was interested in also introducing to the marketplace.
Okay, and when you say that it might have been a bit difficult, how do you think Montrealers received this whole new introduction?
Well, it was a slow burn in the sense that it wasn't exactly what a lot of people expected. I would say there was different reactions from different demographics. For instance, the predominantly black crowds thoroughly enjoyed hearing contemporary gospel as well as traditional quartets as well as chorales. The wider community, the wider market was used to a certain sound and a certain look for gospel music, and they weren't as receptive. But over the years, over time, I think people have gotten to appreciate all styles of gospel music.
And since you grew up around Park Extension, which is like predominantly French, right?
Did you ever? No, it's a very
mixed.
A very, you know, a lot of migrants from Pakistan, Africa now reside there. When I moved there, it was predominantly Greek and a few Haitians. But the community has evolved.
Did you ever get into the French gospel?
That came later. That came, I would say, into the 1990s as I started to do concerts and I started to see the Francophone communities taking an interest in it. And that's when I started to realize there were possibilities. But again, even on the Francophone side, there are different styles of gospel music. Some that are more traditional in style versus some that are more cultural in style as presented by French Africans or Haitians. So you're starting to see gospel music expressed according to your cultural background.
And what do you think has changed in the gospel music industry, and what would you attribute it to?
Now there's a lot of change, and I think that's part because of the music industry changes, where we see less albums, more singles. Mm-hmm. We see now that digital platforms have become the predominant way in which people receive music. Instead of going to the record stores and exploring the credits through albums. And so that has really transformed music in terms of how people receive it and the value that they have with it. But now we're also seeing that gospel music in and of itself has changed in the sense that once upon a time, contemporary gospel music had the ability, like artists like Kirk Franklin, Yolanda Adams, their style and sound was familiar to a cross-section of people. But now they're being, not overshadowed, but there are new figures coming in to the marketplace that are presenting a style of music called praise and worship that is more reflective of the church. Mm-hmm. And so that type of sound is going to be very, very receptive to the church base, but not as receptive, I think, to the overall marketplace.
Okay. Sometimes I feel that there's somewhat of a generational gap that exists. Do you think, what do you think the youth have to learn from mavens like yourself and vice versa?
I'm not a teacher. I really try to stay in my lane and do what's important to me, to my wife, to some of the objectives that I like to pursue short and long term. Along the way, if people ask my opinions, my advice, my counsel, I'll offer it. But I don't necessarily see myself as some kind of figure that is overshadowing or overseeing the local gospel marketplace.
Okay. So what does your professional work day look like? We were speaking earlier and we said maybe we can describe what a Sunday looks like, because it's a packed day for you. So if you take us from morning to evening, what does it look like?
Okay. So usually I'll struggle to pass out at around 10 p.m. and I'll do an early wake up somewhere around the 3:30 a.m. time. And that's just something that has evolved over 28 years of doing the radio show that has been very natural to me. And so I'll get up, I'll start going through my catalog of music, which I've developed over these years, that now numbers over 6,000 to 7,000 albums of gospel music in my home. So I'll play it, I'll review it, I like to curate my playlist. And then I'll start working on a script, I'll start factoring in some of my guests, all of those things. And I'll make my way to the radio show. And I'll do the radio show for the next 3 hours, which to me passes by more like 30 minutes at this point, because we do a lot of interesting things. The banter off air is just as interesting as on air between me and my co-hosts and the guests. When that shuts down, then it's on to other things that are related to gospel music and some things that are not as related to gospel music.
We want to know both.
So it's Sunday. I will like to take that opportunity of taking care of myself. And part of that, especially at this age, is exercise. So that's important to me too. I'll make my way to the gym. I'll get a workout in. I'll come back, and usually either I'll make a nice, elaborate breakfast for me and my wife, or I'll make our way to one of the nice brunch spots that we like in the city. When that's done, then it's back to my workstation and where I'll start working on other things content related. Some of it is related to the internet, working with blackgospel.com, and some of it is personal for a project that I'm working on that has been under works for the last 2 to 3 years. That is actually related to a digital platform that is focused on gospel music.
Awesome. And you said that you were working on a project for the past 2 years?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on what that project consisted?
Yeah. So I would say it was introduced to me back in 2003 with a partner of mine that helped me, that we co-founded another digital website called gospelcity.com. And since we eventually went our separate ways, we had been toying with the idea of launching a digital music platform specifically focusing on gospel music. Won't give away the name, but we have the content, we have the developers in place. It's now just a matter of working out the business arrangement and also working out the arrangement with the labels in terms of royalty shares.
And what's the expected release date? I'm an exclusive now.
I would say late 2019, nice. Early okay. 2020.
Awesome.
Yes.
So what keeps you motivated?
I would say faith. At the end of the day, it is about faith because, you know, you have to look at the man or the woman in the mirror and be comfortable with the man or woman that you see. And usually when I drift away from what's important to me, which is my faith in God, I start to feel not so proud of myself, not so optimistic about the future. So at the end of the day, faith is a necessary component to what I engage in, whether it's on relationships or whether it's on professional ambitions. And when I speak of faith, I'm talking about reading biblical scriptures on a daily basis. I'm talking about prayer on a daily basis. I'm not what you would consider a religious person because I don't necessarily go to church every week. And I am not necessarily identified with any particular church denomination, for the most part. But I like to be have these relationships with pastors around the city, and I like to be a part of the family of believers. So faith is very important.
Okay. Can you describe your creative process pertaining to writing, hosting, producing, and overall creating?
That's a good question, because I think writing is an extremely creative process. Mm-hmm. And I think those words come kind of naturally to me. I'm not calculative. I just go ahead and start writing, and I'll do a series of edits, and then I'll post, and I'll wait for feedback. And sometimes it comes from the artist that I interview. Sometimes it comes from random people around the globe. And those kinds of things are very inspiring. So that's part of the creative process, just sitting down, being silent with yourself, and being just trusting your skills, your talents, your gifts from God. But when it comes to other areas, when you speak about, for instance, doing a concert production, as artistic as it may seem, the process to me doesn't feel like an artistic process. It feels very business. Mm-hmm. It feels very, very tiresome and not as rewarding in many sense, because sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes you draw criticism, sometimes people pat you on the back. So that's something that I do because I love presenting artists. I love music, live music. I think there's nothing better than live gospel music, in my opinion. Live vocalists, live musicians. I think they are far superior to any other genre of music by my perception. But the process is not a very rewarding one because you're dealing with numbers and you're dealing with artists sometimes who have their own particular idiosyncrasies and become sometimes very difficult to deal with. So all of that cannot feel very rewarding.
Okay. And when it comes to writing and you experience a creative block, how do you push through or what do you look for inspiration to get out of that?
Honestly, maybe that's why I feel very, very comfortable with writing, because the times when I've had to sit down and write, it never was laborious. It came very easy. And, you know, to me, struggling to write for an hour or two is not what I would consider a writer's block. I think that's just part of the process. But writing comes comes easier than other areas of my life. That's how I feel.
It's a natural talent. If you can use that statement and say how you distinguished yourself to get attention from the U.S. market, can you tell me about that earlier?
Okay, yes. So, yeah, I've been writing for many years, first with Gospel City as content manager, then with blackgospel.com for many years. And I can remember it was in 2016. It was winter time. And I remember being in my car. And I get an anonymous call from an executive director for television. She's done documentaries with Barack Obama. She's done multiple productions for BET, Celebration of Gospel, et cetera, et cetera. And she just reached out to me and she said that she's noticed my writing online. And she thought I might be an interested candidate for the top job as a lead writer for a new show that she was producing called Joyful Noise. And initially, like most people, I was a little bit suspicious, perhaps even skeptical, you know, because I remember her calling me back the next day and asking why I didn't send her my CV yet. And it was perhaps because I didn't take it that seriously that she really had singled me out. But then when she did call me back and ask for the CV, within an hour I sent it, because that was when I realized that there was a real opportunity that I had to explore and see what came of it. So she made me write some scripts for a potential interview with I think it was Yolanda Adams, what kind of questions I would ask, how would I format it, what areas of her background would I bring into the line of questioning. And I threw all of that in with some creative license. And I think within a, I'd say maybe the next day, she got back to me and she said she shared it with other producers of the show. And she told me that it looked thumbs up, but to wait, wait until I got the good go. Now, I was very, very excited at this point because, you know, you're talking about a flagship television station in the Black community, BET. And you're talking about a new show that was already signed to do 13 episodes. And I was excited. So I shared it with my wife. I shared it with my closest associates. And the funniest thing about the whole experience and all of this, and it kept going on and on and on, because I expected most people to come back and ask, how did you get this opportunity? How did you get hooked up this way? But the funniest thing about it is that every time someone asked me about it, they kept asking me, how much are you getting paid? That was the constant line of questioning. And, well, that led to a whole other series of stories that I, you know, from people asking me for loans, I tell you no lies, to people asking, can you hook me up with a job at BET? So it was a learning experience, and there was a learning curve through this whole process. And I realized that how to handle the situation, even on the local frontier. But I thoroughly enjoyed it because I met some wonderful people with opportunities for the future. I met a lot of artists. I worked for literally 10 days in Washington, D.C. on the BET headquarters. It was just a great experience for a Montrealer. It really was.
How would you say that you grew from writing for BET show?
I guess the growing experience was because I really felt pressure in terms of a timeline. Usually when I write, when you're independent, when you're self-employed, when you're an only child, as I am, you literally do everything according to your own clock. It takes a while to adjust to someone else's expectation. And so that was part of the learning process, in that I had to realize when she called me at 11 o'clock at night and told me she wanted the script at 5 in the morning, I had to get up and complete that script. And there were some areas of stress that I faced on the spot, but I lived up to the expectations of the producers and to myself. So I felt proud in those moments of great tenseness in the process. Yeah.
Great story. I love that story.
Yeah.
In terms of audience feedback and overall like work experience, how would you describe the differences and similarities with working on the Canadian market versus the American market?
Okay. I don't like to generalize about these things because from crew to crew, from people to people, it's always going to be different. But there is a generalization that may or may not be true to some degree, and I think that is that I think Americans, regardless of nationality, are very driven, and part of it is because of their capitalist nature. I can only sum it up that way. Opportunities that they see where there is low-hanging fruit for money opportunities, and they grow for it. Montrealers, and that's why I wouldn't want to generalize to say Canadians in general, because I think that holds true to many pockets of Canada too. But I think here there's also a certain mentality or a certain cultural reality where things are not so pressing. Things, we take our time, we take value in what we do, but there, and our goals and our objectives are not always monetized. You know, we see other values to other things as well. So I guess it's just a matter of what you see personally valuable as a person.
Okay. And who are your mentors growing up and up until this day? Who's your current mentor? Or did you grow up looking up to?
You know, there's been a lot of people in my life. You know, I always, you never really have the greatest of value for family. and your parents until you lose them. And that was true for me, you know, with the passing of my mother in my 20s, where she was a luminous figure in every aspect of my life. And when she was gone, I had to kind of change and grow very quickly. So that, she's always been a mentor when I reflect back on her influence on my life. But over the periods of my life, from past to present, there's been some really special people, business people, pastors. I really appreciate and enjoy the covering and the mentorship of a lot of spiritual leaders that have kind of given me counsel and guidance. But I also take great pride in knowing some very, very entrepreneurial people who have done enormously great things locally, and people that I grew up with going to the private school that I did and watching how they've had great success in their life.
What was a piece of advice that your mom gave to you that still resonates with you today?
She told me two things that that still ring in my head to this day, and I feel a certain degree of regret because I didn't see it through to its finality. But there were other areas of my life that she told me, like she always told me, make sure you find yourself a quality woman, you know. And by that she meant a woman who really had your interest at heart, that could replace her and really look after my ventures, my ambitions, and share in those kind of aspirations as opposed to being perhaps more selfish. I don't know if that's the right word to use. But once committed into a marriage situation, worked as a partnership. So that was something that was very important to me that she said and that I still value today.
Thank you for answering that. Yeah. What was your initial goal when starting the radio show, and do you think you've attained that goal?
Okay, so when we started the radio show, it sounds strange to say it, but it was in 1990. And I remember I was doing some gospel concerts, and I remember a local concert impresario, Ricky D, pulling me aside, telling me that he had gotten a radio show at CKUT, and he had done some broadcasting at an old AM radio station called CKGM. And he was telling me, like, you know, this is something he could see me doing, but for gospel music. And Ricky was one of those guys that I really admired because I saw a lot of him in me, in the sense that we both grew up for a large share of our time in Little Burgundy. We both were in university around the same time. I at Concordia, he at McGill. We both grew up with single parents, West Indian parents. And so I really valued a lot of what he had to say, especially since we had done some projects together. And for the most part, they were enjoyable experiences. So when he told me to maybe throw in an application at CKUT, I said, what do I got to lose? Let's see. And I was really surprised that within a week or two, they got back to me and told me that we're ready to explore this. But you're not going to have prime time. We're going to put you in the graveyard shift. I said, what's the graveyard? They said, 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. You're going to have to find your way to the radio station at that hour. You got to remember, this is when I'm in my early 20s, no car, you know, so I got to figure a way to get to the station in the middle of the night and do it to perhaps nobody who's listening. But it gave us an opportunity, me and a friend of mine at the time, to learn our craft, learn how to spin vinyl, learn how to segue from song to song, and learn how we wanted to present ourselves on air in a way that wasn't offensive, in a way that was appealing for people to listen to. So that was the experience that we did for, I would say, maybe 2 to 3 months. And then they got back to us and said, we got a better spot for you. And I said, well, anything other than in the middle of the night is fine. But when they said Sunday morning, man, I was like overjoyed. It almost seemed kind of providential because we're talking about a time and a day when a lot of Christians like to tune into radio to listen to gospel music. And so when they gave me the opportunity, I jumped at it, and we ran with it, and we started to get feedback. You know, pastors were starting to call us. People were starting to talk about it on the street. And this is before social media, you know, mm-hmm. so it was a slow grind, but people were sharing the news about it. And then strangers were starting to show up at the radio station after to see who we looked like, you know. Mm-hmm. It was really a cool experience for us. And so then we went from really looking at it as a cool thing to share some of our favorite songs with people to starting to take it seriously. Now we started to look at it as we got to be professional about this. We got to respect our craft and respect ourselves as young guys coming up. But, you know, as people of color even, you got to just operate with excellence if you want to be taken seriously. So all of that came into play.
How would you describe your impact that you've had in the Black community in Montreal?
I don't personally gauge those things because I don't know how to gauge those things. I do know that over the years, I've received a lot of positive feedback from different circles, you know, whether it's from media, or whether it's from individuals who are esteemed in our community, and sometimes even outside of our community. But I think primarily the respect and the love comes from people within the community. And it has given me some degree a sense of pride in the whole process, because I didn't go into it looking for that kind of accolades or admiration, but it's something that has developed, and I appreciate every little bit of love, for sure.
Can you tell us about a highlight in your career?
A highlight? When it comes to the radio?
When it comes to putting on huge events, when it comes to radio show, but the one you told me about was about a successful event you had in Montreal.
Yes. And it was, it seems like it was yesterday, but it was actually 2011. And again, it brings my relationship with concert impresario Ricky D into place, because I remember him pulling me aside one day and saying, "Yo, Chris, I think we should bring the biggest gospel artist to Montreal, Kirk Franklin." And he said, "You got relationships in the industry. You reach out to him and see what they say." And I said, "You know what? I think I can make something happen there." So I contacted his manager, someone that I had met a few months earlier in Las Vegas during the Stellar Awards, the Stellar Gospel Music Awards, which is a celebration of gospel music. And we had talked, and I said, "You know, there are people in Montreal that are really interested in bringing Kirk Franklin in 2011. Would you be interested?" He says, "I think the timing is right, because we're coming out with a new album called Hello Fear." And I said, "Perfect. So when I get back, I'm going to give you a call, and we'll start the conversation." And Kirk Franklin is the ultimate gospel artist. We're talking about 10, 11 Grammy Awards, millions of albums sold. And his presence in this city would really not only capture the audience of gospel music lovers, but would begin to break through ceilings and doors of people who don't know gospel music, but I've heard maybe the name of Kirk Franklin and would be interested in coming. So we started the conversation, and initially a lot of people thought he's going to be way too expensive. But he put a number on the table that was palatable for everybody around the table. And we went from taking that number to putting the players in place. There were about 4 or 5 promoters. We sat around the table. We knew our financial obligations. We knew the marketing obligations, and we said, "Are we going to do this? We're going to do this." Now, saying that sounds pretty straightforward and simple, but there was nothing straightforward and simple about it. Because with doing a project like that, I don't mean to overstate it, but haters start coming. And so other promoters who would have loved to have been a part of that process, who weren't invited to the table, started to create barriers. And so churches started saying they want nothing to do with it because there's secular promoters involved. I was the only promoter associated with gospel music around the table. And that created a bit of concern. Then the fact that there were predominantly Anglophone promoters and not enough Francophone promoters created a stir. So the process was one that wasn't easy, but we labored through it for about 5 months. We broke down the door, and we had an enormous turnout at the Palais de Congrès that we all take pride in.
There were like 4,500
I'd say people. About 4,500 Montrealers from across the island and maybe across the province came out to enjoy that night. And it was a spectacular night. It was. Awesome.
What do you love most about what you do? And what would you change if you could?
When it comes to gospel music, I'm happy and I'm proud to take part in any part of the process, whether it's putting on a show, whether it's representing an artist, whether it's presenting music over the airwaves, or whether it's writing an article about gospel music that's published for the world to consume. I'm interested and comfortable in all of it. But again, I think I still take greatest pride and enjoyment in writing. Right.
Yeah. When it comes to the commercialization of gospel music, how do you think it's different from other genres?
Actually, when it comes to commercializing or monetizing gospel music, I don't think there's a whole lot different. I think you have to approach it very much the same way. Absolutely make full use of social media, whether it be Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Make sure that you're constantly present, showing all areas in regards to being an artist, mm-hmm. as an artist. And I think it's important to be present because the industry has really changed in the sense that 5-10 years ago, artists didn't have to worry about those kinds of concerns. They could leave that to the record label, to AR representatives. Now, with the dissolution of record labels, and predominantly, I'd say 90-95% of all artists now are independent, they have to take on ownership of their brand, of their music. So they have to be a part of the process from beginning to end because, one, it's the most affordable way of doing things instead of outsourcing a lot of these things to experts. You can learn through the process and become an expert yourself. But it also gives you a sense of accomplishment, I think, through the process. It might take you away from your artistry, but in the end, it will serve you best in terms of a career.
So you also touched a bit on artist management. Can you tell us about the challenges that arise from managing artists?
So I think artist management is really about having a great relationship with your artist. I think that's where it begins. Because without a good, a healthy, and a stable relationship with your artist, it's invariably going to dissolve. And so you have to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. Sometimes as a manager, based on your experience, based on your knowledge base, you may want to employ a lot of tools, a lot of tactics for your artist to be successful. But if the artist doesn't embrace it, you're going to be at a stalemate. So my advice from experience, going back to the 90s to the present, is that you got to be in one accord with the artist if you're going to make steady progression with that particular artist. And quite honestly, you may have to make concessions. You invariably will have to make concessions because no two people see eye to eye. And if you don't make those concessions, you will have a problem in that relationship. And it may cause you to go a separate way from your artist. Maybe you have to wish them well, you know. But if you want to stay as a partnership, concessions, meeting, being on the same page.
And what kind of professional experience did you draw from when it came to managing your artist?
You know, artist management for me is a sensitive thing because it really requires me to take several steps back and sometimes allow the artist to be the artist that they want to be. And sometimes it might be an unnecessary step in the sense that the artist may feel, for instance, that they want to do a certain style of music or do certain songs as part of their set or their catalog. It might not be good for their brand. It might not even be good for the audience, but it's something that might be very personal to mm-hmm. the artist. Now, you might be in a stalemate right there because you might say, listen, this is not the best direction to go. But the artist may feel very strongly. So what are you going to do? You're going to have to make a concession. You might have to explain yourself a little better and trust that maybe the artist will trust your judgment call on it, but it doesn't always work out that way. And sometimes maybe it's just best to go your separate ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the comedy show that you helped put on in Montreal, the LOL Gospel Comedy Show. I personally attended and I had a great time.
Really?
I was laughing. Yeah, it was hilarious from the host to all the comedians that you brought. It was a great success. Can you tell us about how it was working on that and how you made history in Montreal?
Yeah, so that was working a different muscle in the sense that it is comedy. And comedy is a universal language. People can identify with something that's funny. But the content, as you could hear, was distinctive. It was clean, first mm-hmm. and foremost. And it had several times a theme that was maybe biblical, maybe even made fun of churches or church people. So, and that was something that everybody could identify with, regardless of whether you're religious or not. And again, that was something that was interesting to me because it was new, it was different, and it was a first. And it was something that was brought to me. It wasn't something that I originally thought of. In fact, I was skeptical about it. But again, a couple of other promoters said, hey, let's think about doing it, including Ricky D. Yeah. Said, let's think about doing this. I think it's going to have traction in Montreal. I said, okay, let's do this. And this was something that we had started talking about at the beginning of 29. We had scheduled a date in the spring, but again, doing shows, doing events is not a straight line. There are curveballs along the way, and sometimes you have to go with it. So we had to postpone it several times along the way, but we were determined to get it in 2019. And we're happy, and we love the feedback we've gotten, and I think it's likely we'll do it again.
Amazing. I will be there for sure. From your perspective, what do you think the future of gospel music looks like?
Ah, I wish I could read the crystal ball on that one. Because in many respects, I think it's taken a hit like a lot of other genres of music because of how music is being presented today. The fact that it's digital. When you had the CD, when you had the vinyl in your hand, when you had even the audio tape, those were precious commodities to you. You collected them. You had them in cases or on racks. Today, digital music is not the same kind of commodity. People listen to it, throw it away, or they stream it once and move on. Mm-hmm. So the value for music isn't the same. And so I'm a little worried about what is for a broader sense of perspective, what is the future of music look like? But that is part of the reason why I, along with several people that I work with, are very interested in introducing a digital music platform that is focused on gospel music as its focal point, but can broaden out to include perhaps streaming Christian movies, introducing gospel music from Africa, South America, the Caribbean, across the world. Make that a hub where people who are of faith and people who love gospel music can come. Not iTunes, not Spotify, mm-hmm. but this particular hub that they can embrace as part of their cultural experience.
What does your music collection look like? Is it a combination of like digital and vinyls and...
Well, I do have a Dropbox account, so okay. I do been collecting my own set of gospel music and I store it there. But man, I am old school. Mm-hmm. When an album drops, the first thing I try to do is try to get it on CD. And it's getting harder and harder. Yeah. I go to Amazon, I go to eBay. If it's not there, I'll try to the artist's website to see if they have the CD, because I like to keep it for posterity's sake. I don't want music to be something that is frivolous. I like reading liner's notes. I like looking at the artwork. All of that is very important to me. So I try to get the CDs, but again, even CDs, albums, are becoming a thing of the past. People mm-hmm. are just dropping singles, you know, so we'll see what happens. But as I said, I got a rich collection that is predominantly CDs, and I got about another 500 to 1,000 vinyls.
What piece of advice do you have for those that want to pursue a similar career path as yours?
My advice to anybody who wants to have a career in music is that understand what you're getting into. Don't go into it because it looks kind of lofty and exciting from the exterior. Go into it because that's your passion. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything you do has to be about passion. Something that you could talk about for hours, something that you identify and something that you know from beginning to end. That should be the driving motivation why you're getting into. And so that has been something that has evolved, because when I was in university, you know, I was in university in the 90s in Concordia. And during that period here in Montreal, there were a lot of black males dying, some from black-on-black crimes, some of it from the hands of police. And so I was very, very motivated politically. I got into political science. I was part of a lot of black movements like AKAX. We were hitting the streets, mobilizing black youth, and I thought that was the direction I was going. And I was being pushed by people in those circles to be a spokesperson because I was a Christian. So they saw me as this activist pastor wannabe. So that was an area that I thought I was going to get into. But then my values changed, and I started to see ministry more than activism as an expression of who I was. So, yes, I was as concerned as any other young black male about their lives, but I also felt that the church, Christianity, was a reasonable option for those kinds of issues. And that's the direction I eventually went.
So with so much life and professional experience, what do you think your legacy is going to be?
Legacy? That's a big word. Let's just say that I'm happy to still be a part of gospel music on the local frontier and with many ties in the United States. And I'm happy that the opportunity to do more is still on the table. And I'm going to explore those options and see what amounts from it. But I'm not out to define my legacy. We'll just see how things evolve.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Thanks, girls.
Welcome.